Okay, Matt.
Hi, Bob.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm just going to introduce for the archives that it's December 22nd, 2002, a Sunday, Toronto to Manhattan. And I have Tim here, so I'm going to pass you over. He's all yours.
Hello.
Hey, Tim.
Hey.
What do you want to tell me?
Well, I was talking to Matt about this, the whole Android meme and the whole idea of the messages, the media, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, he was telling me about the Matrix specifically and how the artist is generally the closest person to break out of the Matrix every now and again. Now, how is that possible? How is the artist the one who comes out of the Matrix more so than the common man, per se?
All right, so Matt is defining Matrix as some kind of environment not specific to how we understand it in the 90s through the movie, but something, I guess, that goes back centuries.
Right.
All right? So that would be just the technological, linguistic environment that the society is living in. And the traditionally, the artist or any person who sees through the dynamics of his time,
right,
his or her time, would be how art's defining the artist. I mean, how Matt is defining the artist.
Right.
So we're going to have to use general principles, not in the particular about our time.
I see, yeah, because I was thinking more along our time in the sense that generally artists are driven financially with what's going on and what is financially beneficial as what's going on in art, with whether it be film or music or visual or performance, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, no, what's interesting today is that the artist is the one who creates the Matrix. He is the propagandist today.
Right.
So the artist per se, as we culturally understand it in the West, is not the right term for the person who gets out of the Matrix.
I see.
We're flooded by a surfeit of creativity in all media and all forms of expression. That's been the history of the 20th century.
So how can an artist influence through the actual medium itself, through the actual use of, you know, radio or television?
Well, an artist per se in any medium can't anymore. The artist is the ruler today, the real emperor, and that's who we're. The artist is the enemy today.
It's the enemy.
Yeah, in after World War II, the artist per se, as we culturally knew it, is the enemy. So Matt's not using the right term to apply today. It's a correct term for before the 20th century, but not today. Now, how could that be? Because in the West, the artist is such a cultural hero, at least since the telegraph.
Okay.
And remember, the artist was a court-appointed situation 200, 300, 400 years ago. And that's only in Western societies where the artist created something for a public, and then before that just serviced the king or the emperor or the court or the pope. But in other cultures, there was no separate artist, an artist who created a product that was sold. So in other cultures that didn't have a market, the artist was just an ordinary person doing very well in whatever craft they did. And they didn't even have the concept. It's only the concept of the West that people think of now, and that was created out of the West over the last 300 or 400 years. It's only been a couple hundred years for the artist creating his own public in writing, in painting, and music. I mean, all the great heroes of the West are those that created their own markets.
Right.
And now, when you brought in radio and TV in before and after World War II, then the medium itself, which was created by scientists or technologists, the medium itself required a lot of content.
Mm-hmm.
And so they brought in people who could do entertainment. And they brought them from vaudeville for radio. They brought them from theater for movies.
Right.
And then both of those became content for TV.
Yes.
So if we think of the artist, and the way Matt is defining the artist is someone who sees through the Matrix and provides a way of seeing beyond the Matrix, or a way of not being fooled by it. And that could include a politician who sees something and then wants to create a counter environment to the Matrix. That's what Ben Franklin and them did. They were artists in politics who took the advantage of a new country to separate from Europe and to create a new culture.
So generally, essentially anyone in front of any kind of public eye would be considered an artist?
As Matt is defining art, yeah. Anybody who, not necessarily in the public eye, but who provides a revolution in perception. And the effect of that revolution can be political, it can be spiritual, it can be entertainment-wise, it can be cultural. It's basically an inspirational offering. Inspirational offering that's interpreted different ways.
Right.
Now, when the scientists invented television, television itself was inspirational. My God, people thought, I can see. They thought they could see.
Right.
They didn't think of hearing, but they said, I can see other parts of the world. That was the biggest mind-blowing cultural product up to that point. It was greater than painting or music or anything or movies.
Mm.
So there is a cultural fact. But once you have the TV, a culture wants to fill it up with content. And so any previous form of expression becomes a means of offering content. So movies ran on to TV, became the late show at first.
Mm-hmm.
And then the newspaper interview was converted into the talk show. So all these people that provided content,
right,
were traditionally artists in some entertaining or capacity. But they weren't necessarily great artists, inspirational artists.
True. Well, this is what I was thinking as well with the whole idea of anyone can put themselves on the internet now as a spell for like spectacle and put themselves on, have their own website and be hit and watched and seen. That's not necessarily being an artist. That's just like voyeurism and or just the sake of having someone watch you, having that electronic eye on you.
Right. And that was the democratization of the TV world of the 50s and 60s, which was limited to talented people or some kind of talent or some kind of eccentricity. The
right.
Democratizing has killed the sense of an artist, capital A artist, who offers perception. So how do we offer perception in this situation where, in effect, communication and information and inspiration are obsolete? Because nobody could dominate it, and anybody could offer anything, and then therefore the variety that's offered becomes just a synaptic stimulus, just something to titillate you for a few seconds or a few hours.
Right.
All right, let's just go step back on the... I was talking about the... if you have a question at this point, just remember it, but I just wanted to say...
Okay.
So when TV provided a new inspiration, and then the artist came in as content, what then was unforeseen, as people were entertained, they didn't realize that the medium itself, the constituents of the TV X-ray tube, the thing that it did to perception, would cause effects all through society in institutions and people. So a quick inventory of the revolutions of the 50s and 60s were largely caused by the television.
Right. Now, what if it was...
So that upset society. So at a certain point, the inspiration that TV caused slipped into a great disservice, at least from those who ran older institutions. And at that point, you had chaos, because nobody could stop the TV. And then it became satellized and computerized.
Right.
Okay, so what were we going to say?
I was thinking about the whole idea of stepping back. So if TV is doing this whole desensitizing, what about stepping back towards like actual live theater and doing a live approach of like getting a message across that way as an artist?
Okay, look at the words you use. TV doesn't desensitize us. It alters our sensory preference and threatens older institutions which were built on different sensory preferences. Basically, it was post-literate and shocked all the literate institutions of the previous couple of hundred years.
Mm.
Now, then you're saying, what about live theater? Now, remember, TV, I would say, is alive. Before you brought in canned TV, it was actual someone living in the present, interacting with you. It wasn't in an old theatrical proscenium arch. It wasn't in the theater. So you're saying, how can the theater person, traditional theater institution, which is made minor under the new TV environment, how could that inspire people? Well, I don't think it can, other than it just becomes another medium, another form of entertainment that provides... replays of former theater greats or any new stuff, which is, sir, it becomes a therapy. It's an antidote to the common TV experience. So in Toronto, you had a great revolution in theater in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
Because a lot of people by that time are not going to be numbed by TV. TV's been around for 20 years. They want other sensory experiences, so they go to older media. But it's only a form of release, like an aspirin.
Like an aspirin.
It's like an aspirin. And then that for all those older arts, they all in Canada had to go on grants economy.
Right, yes, they did.
Because they really weren't the real action, because there was nothing that could stop the perceptual change that TV was causing. And then when it was computerized, cableized, and then satellized all through the last 30 years, which created other kinds of phenomena, basically had a society in a total uproar, and other society's uproar, and while people lived every day in that uproar, to get an aspirin, they listened to an album, they went to the theater, they read a book,
right, right.
Fill in time. And that was what McLuhan meant when he said, culture is our business. The separation between the artist as non-commercial and offering some kind of counter-inspiration, counter-environment that's inspirational, had lost its function after World War II. It became part of commerce. And that's what Andy Warhol represented, the commercialization of art, the recognition of it.
Yeah.
But because he did it at first, it seemed to offer a perspective that was unique in the art context.
Interesting. Now, Matt has referred to me as his own, like his Garrett Dean, and he'd explained a little bit of it, but explain Garrett Dean to me from your perspective.
Garrett Dean was a man I met in Nova Scotia when I was stationed there in the 50s and 60s, and he was born in Nova Scotia in 1907, very talented young kid. He went to New York when he was like 19, so that's 1926, 1927. He went into theater. At first, he was a model to get by. Then he got into theater. And in the 30s, he interacted with Eva LaGallien, who set up one of the first repertory theaters in New York in the 30s. He saw all the stars that went on to Hollywood. He acted with them. He never went to Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
He was too much of an individualist. So he stayed in New York and saw the whole parade of New York culture from the late 20s till the late 60s. But by the late 60s, he didn't like the way New York was changing. He didn't like what Rockefeller did when he built the Hilton Hotel around 53rd Street, I think it is.
Okay.
It wrecked the area, the Midtown New York, that that he had was his haunt. And so he went back to Dartmouth and spent at least 6 months there. And as the 70s went on, he spent even more time and would go back to New York less and less. But I met him, and he just was a good thinker, talker, and a unique individual, which in the 50s and 60s when I knew him, when I first met him, he stood out because people weren't like that in the 50s and 60s. Actually, and even though he could be many different kinds of people, he was a throwback to the original bohemians of the 19th century.
Okay.
But he also was not limited to that. So he was my personal inspiration, my personal prophet, personal artist.
I see. Yeah, because Matt was trying to explain there's certain specific offices, and he represented that office of the theater, the artist, per se.
No, that's the way I present it is that's the personal inspiration.
Oh, okay.
The other holy offices are, I use the trivium and the quadrivium, basically rhetoric, grammar, and dialectics, and then music, arithmetic, geometry, and one other, astronomy. Those were the traditional seven arts of the last 2,000 years.
Right.
Medieval education, Greek education. And then I added on to that the occult art, which is mediums or whatever. And then I added the personal thing, because you can read and study things, literature, these different entertainment, or these different old arts, but it's always one person who is your particular John the Baptist or the thing that... that you get in a personal interaction.
Yes.
And so I call that a holy office or a division of education, the personal
right.
influence.
Great.
So he's saying that you had a great personal baptism on him.
Oh, that's good to know.
I didn't know
or
that.
Or bad to know, depending on how I've influenced him.
Right. Well, how long has this been going on?
Let's see. I've known him since I was about 14, I guess. So
oh, okay. You're
back in the
buddy.
Theater days, yeah.
Oh, and you got him into theater?
No, he was in theater as well when we'd met in high school, I guess it
right.
was, and we'd met through theater and in the actual high school that we were going to. So
are you in theater now?
Yeah, yes, I am. Acting, writing, that sort of thing.
Okay, so what it is, it's a job.
Yeah.
Right? The traditional idea of the artist who would be off creating his own art and the public or the emperor or the pope liked it, The image is that this guy or woman has slack. They're able to do something that really has no food value. You can't eat it. But it has some kind of social value that somebody in authority recognizes, and the person gets to indulge their talent, right?
Yes.
And it had an important role. Now, the slack that the traditional artist was supposed to give, at least in the 19th century, the idea of some kind of individual expression, and you not have a 9-to-5 job, you have more time to do what you want to do, and you do it, and the public responds. I have not seen that in the arts since before World War II.
Interesting.
And so you, now, it then becomes a relative thing, because you probably would rather write and create theater products than work in a factory.
Of course.
Right?
Yes.
So it still has that glamour, that slack, that freedom, but it's within a larger world environment that it's like you are service. You're making an aspirin, just like the automobile guy makes a car, which is an aspirin,
right,
compared to all the electronic media. But your aspirin requires a little more slack in the independence in the way you put it out. So it's a better way of doing slack, of doing making an aspirin for people, theater,
right,
than the other one. So people romanticize that, or when they want to gravitate toward that kind of lifestyle, they see that as offering a little more comfort than the factory thing.
Yeah, it seems like it's a bit more fulfilling, like you're giving something back, at least in a way that it's not just a product that's being placed out there that someone comes to and takes it for face value. They can actually walk away with something more than that.
Yeah, now I say that's culturally blind, because people think that in our culture we worship the abstract idea or the inspiration it gets from. We're cerebral people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's traditional in the West. What's interesting is that we have romantic notions of how it satisfies that need, but if you look at the larger context, it is not offering perception in an anti-environment to what is really causing problems, which is the information addiction that people have, which not doesn't allow any situation to grab a hold of the public so that something can be accomplished in a definite trend for a long time. The attention span's too short. Do you
right.
remember the TV series called The Newsroom?
Yes.
Okay, I just, someone lent me a collection of the cassettes, so I just watched it the last few months,
mm-hmm.
and I just saw the last show. But that show showed the idea that news was supposed to inform people, protect people, whatever. It showed by the 90s how corrupted and irrelevant news was,
mm-hmm.
or The Newsroom was, right?
Yes.
So the thing is, we are prejudiced. We don't see that theater does that, or painting, or the cultural situation, any of the old traditional cultural arts, that they're just aspirins.
Right.
It's only that you can get more slack doing that than a harder hardware job.
Fair. Yeah.
So, now what, there was another point there. The other thing is, though, still when you're doing that thing in Canada especially, there's a lot of tension because you rely on grants, you got to fill out a lot of forms, and
right.
sometimes there's cutbacks, and then you're stranded. So it even the slack is supposed to give you only is intermittent because there's always a scrambling to get another project.
Yeah, well, I mean, financially, I mean, it's never been that beneficial in Canada. There's two different spectrums. You're either the young, struggling artist who's trying to do the work that you can, or you've got the grants and you become the high roller, the mainstream kind of artist. There's no really happy medium.
Right, and then there's all kinds of complications that come out of that. But what so what we have to realize is that the older, more forms of communication are like drugs, and they are antidotes to the larger drug of a TV society.
I see.
And then we finally came to the point where other cultures couldn't take it anymore, so they bombed us. and the artists and the cultural content that was provided were part of the agitation.
I see. Agitation. How is the artist the agitation?
Oh, the constant news.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you know, the constant information. I mean, if... remember in the 50s, the TV networks here in New York, they hired the best talent from the older media, the older arts, to provide content. And then TV became a drug. Because they never thought, well, this is a very powerful medium. Why don't we turn it off every 6 months, have a six-month fast, so that people could recognize that it was changing them in ways that none of the arts foresaw, nobody foresaw. Nobody thought of turning the medium on and off, so it just became a constant rainstorm.
Right.
And people didn't see that it was a rainstorm. They just enjoyed different shows that they liked.
But then how is that not numbing if it's a constant battering?
Oh, that's numbing.
Oh, it is.
That's why we recommend the the turning it off every 6 months.
Hmm.
So then we become aware, oh, my God, I was dependent so much on it.
Hmm.
Or that it was affecting me psychically, and I didn't realize it. Because
hmm.
as long as I was looking at what I liked on the TV, I didn't notice the disservices of it.
Right, right.
So the and so let's say that's a real serious problem, that television was numbing society. How would you, how would anybody bring in mediacology? That would be the toughest thing to do, because so many of the population who were working in hard jobs enjoyed the anesthetic, the aspirin the TV gave.
Yeah, the release, the
release.
Escapism.
So it's almost like at that point, that's when we became, in the late 90s sense of the Matrix, that was, that's when we lost our human, our at least human image that we had from before when there were communities and some kind of human scale. We became cyborgs. Before the computer space came in, it happened with radio.
Yeah, yeah.
And then television. And that's when the Matrix was created, in the sense that McLuhan wrote about and inspired the movie The Matrix.
Right, right.
And that's the movie Videodrome.
Movie Videodrome.
Yeah, have you ever seen that by Cronenberg?
No, I don't think I have.
Yeah, it was based on McLuhan, and a McLuhan character, a perverted McLuhan character who took advantage of the television set, you know, vampirizing people. And that was Cronenberg's sort of black horror motif of describing the media taking over society and turning people into cyborgs.
Right.
But that was before the term cyborg was popular.
Ah. I'll have to look that one up then.
Right. Oh, yeah. Okay, so the... So what it is, we're discussing what is valuable, what is, and then what is inspirational, what is the real, if art is an important role, how can one, how can an artist provide an antidote to this overall numbing situation?
Hmm.
It's almost impossible. How could anybody inspire people?
It's a big question. I don't know if I have this, if there is an answer, if a proper answer for that
right.
matter.
But I recommend it. When I used to do my radio show just 15 years ago, I presented this question as a question for all fields, from economics, politicians, to artists, to scientists, to anybody, as this is the agenda or the question that should be said, not pollution and all these other racism and all the other issues that are cliches in the news. Those were just side effects that were exacerbated by the TV maelstrom. So the question would be, if you really wanted to do anything about it, if you were pretending to have a serious effort, you had to deal with the TV vortex. And so McLuhan was the one who did that. He said the only way to solve it is, you can't do it by better education, better this or that, because TV is an environment that swallows the whole society. So he just had to turn it off. That was the simple answer.
Right.
And that's how he would have created perception, just by turning off the flood of numbing.
Interesting.
So that was an artistic act that, as we've defined it, of overcoming the Matrix. But he couldn't get anybody to believe him.
To go along with him, yeah.
And so, you know, he came up with a very cagey situation. He says, okay, if we can't do that, we can at least use the new post-TV medium, the computer, to orchestrate whole societies. Since we know we can't give up technology, then we use the computer to inventory how different societies were using whatever technologies they were using. There were different stages. Some were just, in the 50s, just in the radio, like the Middle East, which caused the Arab-Israeli wars in the 60s, the inflaming of tribal hatred. So he said, we use a computer that inventories the news and sensory thresholds of whole populations, and we would modulate. We would have TV put, its effect would be useful in society that only had radio. So you would put TV into that society.
Right.
In the society that had TV, you'd turn it off so they weren't too numbed out by the TV medium. And then for the people too electrified, you'd shut them all off and give them newspapers. So you'd modulate the different media. And it'd be run like headquarters would be like a laboratory doing collective drugging of people using different media aware of their characteristics.
Right.
So that was another big scale plan he was laying out. And he said, look, just as we modulate the economy with the fluctuating interest rates, and that's the way the economy was since World War II, that's just organizing the money medium. Why can't we do it on broader corporate new media terms of modulating it? We accept the programming that the Federal Reserve and the states does. and whatever it's called in Canada, and we accept the robotization of the economy and the modulation and massaging of it, why don't we modulate the larger media? But the reason people didn't even understand that is they thought the larger media was just entertainment.
Huh. Right. Well, there it is.
Yeah, that's the proposition he laid out.
Hmm.
Yeah, more important than E equals MC squared. I mean, that it was the new Einstein in a sense. E equals MC squared was a nice thought experiment or a statement of what was happening with the materials that society developed by 1910. So
okay.
A new situation had happened by 1960. So it required a new metaphysician or a new thinker. A new thought experiment.
McLuhan had that, the medium is the message.
Yeah. But just as in the 20s and 30s, nobody really understood Einstein, but he was an icon. In the 60s and 70s, McLuhan was an icon, but nobody understood him with what he was really saying.
No, I don't know if they still understand him today for that matter. So.
No, they don't. Now, I'm not saying that McLuhan had the answers or was a great guru. I'm just saying that he had the genius to discover some new knowledge or some new ways of looking at what was happening.
Right. Well, makes sense. Yeah. Great. Well, that answers a lot of questions and it provokes a lot of thought for myself, anyways, as where I'm coming from as an artist. So.
Right. So what kind of materials or performance do you write?
Well, I'm working on a lot of film stuff right now, but it's not my own work. The stuff that I'm working on is actually more personal, on a personal level, with my cultural background, which is West Indian, and trying to put a show together with that, with just bringing a different culture into the Canadian content, in a sense of there's not a lot of West Indian voice within the Canadian theater scene. So right now I'm just looking at producing this work based on generally the idea of like growing up as a white West Indian we're growing up with a black background in the white suburbs.
Right.
As a white person, for that matter, so.
With a black background, but as a white, you mean the white culture is imposed on you?
Yes.
Yeah. So, okay, now, what you're asking for, now you would do that in the...
Theater would be the venue, the genre. That
yeah, which theater?
Just a small black box theater, really, to start, or wherever.
Right. Now, the thing is that this is an example of... in the TV environment, we're all really like electrons. If you actually look at the body structure we have inside this new medium, this new matrix, now you want to draw attention to historical facts that there was a culture, a black culture that came to Canada and how it interacted, you know, in the 70s and 80s with this industrial culture, which was actually inside a TV maelstrom. So you're nostalgically retrieving. Now, I'm not saying this as a put-down, but you're bringing up something, because you aren't a West Indian, even on the telephone you're not.
No.
You're electrified. You're something else in terms of how your brain's perceiving it.
Right.
But when you get off the phone or when you walk around and you're not in a direct interaction, in direct interactive media or you're listening passively, you are a black person or whatever you look like, and you walk around and people on a human scale react to you that way.
Well, my background is West Indian. I am Caucasian, but my background is West Indian.
Oh,
so.
Okay. But the thing is, people will see what you are and how you present yourself to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was interesting is the Russians, they thought in the 40s and 50s, 60s that America was undemocratic because they didn't see that the working class had access to the media. And what they meant by access is they didn't get their stuff shown, didn't become content on the radio and TV of North America.
Okay.
And they said that they did. So they would have content that listed, inventories of the industrial output that day.
Right.
Physical stuff, which, you know, for us...
So we're late to the working man.
Yeah. Well, for us, would be ridiculous content from our cultural perspective. Now, the larger point, though, is that the Russians believe that access to presenting your particular story was real democracy.
Hmm.
Whereas we had a whole individualistic approach to culture and access to the media. You competed to get to be... and receive the attention, then you were the one that was the content. Now, what is political correctness in the culture wars of the 80s was that different old cultures demanded access to the media. And what was interesting, as the North American society in the 50s and 60s was molded and changed by television,
right.
Actually what McLuhan called tribalized, even though it was more particular than tribalizing, but just to make it simple, it was tribalized, then every tribe... demanded their, like the Soviet approach, that we should be on the media. So you had to have tokenism. You had to have a black news person or this and that.
Right.
And that became called political correctness.
Yes.
And so but all of that was obsolete in the sense that nobody could deal with the virtualization of all cultures and the larger electronic digital storm that was coming, which affected everybody. And anybody actually looked at what the immigrants worked, or even the previous cultures, races, the whites, they all had digital jobs, and they were not being West Indian, French, or whatever in their
right.
jobs.
It was all just a matter of
matrix.
Right.
And so then a lot of culture, aspirin, in other media like theater, tended towards, as like in Toronto, I remember in the late 80s, a lot of Native Canadian Indian stuff came out. And
yeah.
the playwrights were offered.
Right.
But it was not individualism, it was group minds, old cultural group minds that were presented as anesthetic in the older media. So I see what you're offering is you're saying, I want access for my story, which represents a culture, to be told as one of the Bayer aspirins
to
counter the impersonalization, the superhumanization of the digital media.
Ah, okay. Oh.
So that's a question about what you're doing.
I see. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's a necessary story that needs to be told because there's no stories like it out there.
Right.
But
there are other cultures that went through what you're going through that probably have their writers.
Yes.
I mean, what's his name? Nino Rota?
I'm not sure.
Okay, he's an Italian-Canadian who wrote a novel in the early 90s. I remember just leaving Toronto,
okay.
and he was that was the beginning of, from what I just picked up, was that the new fad in the 90s was baby boomers and younger novelists and that were writing stuff about being other non-white cultures coming to Canada and describing their life in their local communities. That was becoming a new market for cultural
right.
content. And so what you would want to present is one of many that have been presented and are trying to be presented.
Right.
But it's always, you're always feeling marginal.
Hmm.
And every culture, including the establishment WASP culture, was marginalized once we got into the digital area.
Right.
Because
okay.
we'd all become cyborgs, which were not culturally culturally signified, culturally identified, culturally specific.
Yes. Well, I think it's very distinct in Canada to have the tossed salad as opposed to the melting pot of the United States. Whereas there's so many different cultures that have a larger expression as opposed to in the United States where it's more of a melting pot where at first you're an American as opposed to a Afro-American or an Indo-American.
Right.
But you're always the American first and foremost.
Now, you think Canadians think that's better than the melting pot?
Well, I don't know if it's better, but different. It's a broader diversity from what I've learned from my studies of cultural experiences within the United States and Canada.
So why do you think there is a difference? Why did this difference happen?
I'm not sure exactly. I don't know. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, well, one thing is I would say that the printing press is what really America was founded on. With Ben Franklin and those guys. So the printing press is a homogenizing medium. It turns everybody into a flat, uniform sociological space, and that was called being an American.
Right.
Now, so were the Canadian culture. But because the Canadian culture didn't become as industrialized and is so populated, and didn't create as big a matrix, then the cultural identities were preserved longer. In the 19th century, and when you started into the 20th century, they were there stronger because they weren't inside the industrial machine as much as the United States, and also because there were such huge spaces between people in the land and just a thin population along the border, and they required national communication networks like the National Railway.
Right.
All these factors made Canada a slower place that preserve the cultural identities. And so you couldn't have crushed them like rock. As the American industrial matrix did.
Oh, okay.
So it's just that basically North America was chewed up by the industrial structure of the United States. It's just that there was this border that made Canada poor cousins. And in relation to that, and then they also developed values of community and medical welfare that a lot of Americans wish they had now.
Right, yeah. Yeah, more of a socialist idea as opposed
yeah.
to.
Yeah, and the socialist almost is more human scale.
Hmm.
Because you could never stop the technological dynamo of the United States to actually make it fair for everybody.
Yeah, there's a lot. It's too capitalist driven as opposed to.
And too much new stuff upsetting.
Hmm.
Upsetting everything and causing changes and new hijackers of new power relations caused by new media. So it was the virtual storm that McLuhan was describing in general for the world, but he was watching it happen in the United States first.
Ah.
And so, you know, Canada, as Marshall used to say, was a 19th century country, well into the 20th century,
hmm.
in terms of human scale of industrial services and electronic services. So, you know, when you come in, have you ever been to New York City?
Yeah.
Okay, you come there, it's just a big mega monster.
Yeah.
It goes on. And it's like a microcosm of the North American continent, specifically the United States border.
Mm.
And that's what, you know, New York City is a concentration, a mini hologram of what goes on over the whole country.
Mm, yeah. It's very, very fast-paced, very, very go, go, go all the time, I noticed when I was in New York.
Yeah,
as opposed to Toronto, which is almost like it's a flip side of the United States, the metropolis of Manhattan, where it's a bit more relaxed, but yet it's still trying to build up and be that kind of United States fast-going pace kind of city.
Right. Well, New York is a bizarre place because, you know, America is not only a visually organized around the printing press. Once the industrial structures came in, it became kinetic, motion and mobility. And the real bias of Americans is movement.
Hmm.
And Manhattan itself is a place that people can live and walk around with without having to drive cars.
Yeah.
They've got the cabs for the mobility. They've got the subways. But a lot of people in New York grew up without getting a driver's license. But for the majority of Americans, you got to have that.
Yeah.
And then because Manhattan is like a concentration camp, and then it has radio, TV, and all the media, it really is the orbiting matrix. It comes out of New York, the content. And that is that's a bigger environment than America outside of New York City is. New York
right.
has all, the rest of America has all these things, but the hectic, sort of like the black hole of making media content is New York City, and the outer rings are the rest of the United States, and then Canada is just a little moon, a little more placid, floating off on the edge. So you say that you see that New York is, you know, amazing speed, but
mm-hmm.
also a kind of calm at the center.
Hmm.
But it is not an American city as America likes to think of itself, that old 19th century values of virtue and honesty and industriousness and working on the farm or doing a good
yeah.
job. That's not New York City. That's the rest of the United States.
Hmm,
but those values, which Reagan represented in the 80s, were obsolete. They weren't really what was going on.
Huh.
So that Americans think that Toronto and Canada is a wonderful place. Because that actually, as Canada got a little more caught up to the States, at least
right.
caught up to the 50s of the States, friends of mine, when they go to Toronto, this reminds me when I grew up in Kansas in the 40s. You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that actually Canada is the image that Americans have of themselves, the more recent Canada,
hmm.
as they confront the disappearance of America into this virtual matrix, which is represented by New York. And that may be why Canadians are the comedians for the Americans. This may be the reason, because the Canadians grew up in a place which has human scale. They still can do interpersonal humor and have
right.
media savviness because they can look at it with a bit of detachment. And that's actually where the American consciousness last was before it disappeared completely.
Hmm.
So Americans would find that Canadians can be Americans as they remembered Americans to be.
Right. Because we can still laugh at ourselves and not get so uptight about it.
Yeah, it was just that we're a slower culture, and entertainment has to be rear-view mirror anyways.
Hmm.
It can't be about the present. That's just too much. The present is the news.
Right.
You know, Dan Rather and these people coming on telling you, you know, 30 million people wiped out by a Bhopal, you know, somebody blew up the nuclear reactor or something.
Yeah.
So you hide from that. And so I'm saying that the image of Canada in the 40s and 50s could not be a necessary content for Americans. But the majority of Americans who were in the 80s and 90s who were not in New York City but just average slow-moving Americans that the Bush and Reagan appealed to, their image of themselves,
mm-hmm.
which is slow, slower than New York City in the real matrix, is met by Canada, who is a little speeded up in the 80s, in the 70s, 80s, and can offer Saturday Night Live and comedy.
Right. Great. the comedians, us Canadians. All right, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to pass you off to Matt here, but it was great talking to you. Got some good perspective on some of the things that I'm looking at and thinking about, so that's fantastic.
Okay, great, Tim, and anytime you want to do some more, just come back.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks a lot. It's a real pleasure. Have a happy holidays, by the way.
You too, Tim.
Okay.
Maybe I'll see your play sometime.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Talk to you soon.
All right.